Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hi, everybody. Bienvenidos, bienvenidas. Welcome back to New Books in Latin American Studies. I'm Pamela Fuentes, the host of the channel. Today we'll be talking to Dr. Judith Lipton about her new book, Strength Through Peace, How the Militarization Led to Peace and Happiness in Costa Rica, and what the rest of the world can learn from a tiny tropical nation. Book recently published by Oxford University Press, and this is a book she wrote in collaboration with David P. Barish. Judith, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Pamela. I'm very happy to be here. Very excited to be here.
I wonder if you could begin the interview by telling us a little bit about yourself.
I am 67 years old. I have lots of roles that I play. I'm the mother of three children, and two of them have children, so I'm grandmother of four children. I say that first. And that's important in Latin America. That would be one of the major things, I think, one would want to know. I'm a psychiatrist by training, which means that I'm a medical doctor, and my specialty was psychopharmacology, which means drugs and the mind. I fancied myself as being a little bit like Julia Child's. And French cooking, I was really good, earned my living as a cook for people with severe psychiatric disorders who needed treatment. And I practiced from 1979 to 2009 when I closed my practice in order to go and live in Costa Rica. So since 2009, I've been working as an author, not as a practicing psychiatrist. I've never taken a course in psychology. People get confused about psychiatry and psychology, and I'm married to David Barish. David is a zoologist. David has also never taken a course in psychology, even though he's emeritus professor of psychology at the University of Washington. So we are together evolutionary biologists. That's most of our work has been about evolution based on natural selection. We also are diehard, very committed peace activists. We've been working with prevent nuclear war, against war, almost full time since 1979. So David has written 40 books altogether. I've had the privilege of co-authoring 8 or 9 of those. The Costa Rica book that just came out is the first one I've been first author on. So I'm very excited about that. We speak of ourselves as co-shareholders in our fitness because of being grandparents, and co-shareholders of our academic, you know, gifts to the world because we've collaborated so well.
As part of this collaboration, why did you and David decide to write Strength and Peace? How did you both come with the idea of exploring peace, happiness, and demilitarization with the background you have? How all of that came into play?
On the night that Obama was elected in 2008, we left early that morning to go to Puebla, Mexico, to go to kind of a, we were speakers at a TED conference in Mexico. And with the money that they paid us, we took a vacation to Costa Rica. And we specifically went to a horse farm. And I love animals. I love all animals, but especially dogs, cats, and horses. So we went to a horse farm, and I felt completely in love. I felt like I'd come home because we were living in a small cottage with monkeys in the trees and parrots in the trees, horses everywhere, and one can ride a horse from where you're staying to a local restaurant, tie the horse to a tree, go for a swim, have lunch at a Michelada, ride home. It was perfect. And I just fell arse over tea kettle in love with Costa Rica and decided to go back for a longer visit. So in the fall of 2009, I went for 6 months, and then we bought a house there. And what happened was that in 2011, Nicholas Kristof wrote an article about Costa Rica describing Costa Rica as the happiest nation in the world. Because we were so happy there, Kristof was so happy there, we thought, okay, why not write a book about it? It just seems that's how we work together. We just decide to write books. And so we began to explore the topic of, was Costa Rica really the happiest country in the world? What is happiness? What did that mean? It turned out to be a dead end. It turned out that the literature, science behind claiming that Costa Rica was the happiest nation in the world didn't hold up. That claim was based on the Gallup Corporation making 1,000 phone calls in Costa Rica, but also 1,000 calls in China, 1,000 calls in India, 1,000 calls in Malta, 1,000 calls in Liechtenstein. And somehow, it didn't seem right to me scientifically that 1,000 calls in Costa Rica would be equivalent to 1,000 calls in India. I couldn't see how that worked. Also, the questions that they asked were things like, would you like to have another day just like yesterday? And that's an interesting question, but hardly substantive. They also use something called a Cantrell ladder, which is on a scale of 0 to 10, where 10 is the happiest possible it could be, and 0 is the most sad possible it could be. Where are you? And they asked that. But there was no, that kind of question at the basis of happiness psychology. It turned out that no other serious organizations use those questions to evaluate the well-being of their citizens. For example, Costa Rica does not ask that question in its annual State of the Union assessment. In fact, they don't actually ask a single question about subjective well-being. So we worked and worked and worked for 2 years. And then finally, wrote to our editor at Oxford and said, we can't do this. Not going to work. The happiness literature is too scattered. We can't live in it. The only thing we know for sure about Costa Rica is that they abolished their military in 1948. They have not had an army since 1948. They haven't had a war. They've had two wars in 400 years. And that's all. With a total of 4,000 casualties. And, you know, Costa Rica is not in an especially peaceful neighborhood. But the health, well-being, and tranquility in Costa Rica is an outlier compared, say, to its neighbor Nicaragua or other countries in Latin America. So we decided to simply look at how demilitarization happened, what the process was, and what the implications were for the rest of the world. And our editor said that would be okay, and the book got rewritten.
Yeah, and you explain us all of those elements through every of the chapters. So if it's okay with you, let's start with some of the ideas that actually are useful for our audience in order to have a context. For instance, when starting the book, opening the first chapter, the reader finds two important ideas that I would like you to explain more in depth. The first one is happiness that you already mentioned. And in fact, the book opening lines are an observation of happiness you took from Anna Karenina.
Yes.
And the other one is the idea that Costa Rica experiences a paradox. Could you please explain to the audience the particular paradox of this country and how it is related to happiness?
Happiness has been defined by philosophers even way before Aristotle, in India, you know, around the time of the Buddha and Ashoka, people have tried to define what makes a good life or happy life. There's no general agreement. And also part of the problem is there's no agreement on whether happiness is a transient thing, like the smile on your face when I answer a big question, or the smile on my face when I see my dog, or whether happiness is the sum of living a good life. Aristotle felt that happiness had to be added up and that it really couldn't be considered happy till you were dead, and that the sum of your good deeds would result in your overall happiness. That's a kind of an extreme point of view. It's a very elusive concept. We all kind of know happiness when we feel it, but how do we sum it up or say it? There is a good reference called the World Institute of Happiness that listeners could log on to or reference quite a bit in the book. It lists all of the studies of happiness, and happiness is also called subjective well-being, or SWB, where you can look at the tests for happiness, assessments, history. So as a psychiatrist, I was never trained about happiness at all. Psychiatrists live in the world of misery. So I know all sorts of questions about how to evaluate misery. I quantify dysthymia, depression, all sorts of things. But happiness has not been a subject, a psychiatric subject. So in our book, the quote from Anna Karenina was, all happy families are alike, all unhappy families are different. It's called the Anna Karenina principle. And we explored that a lot, because if you look at, in the Wikipedia, and you go look at the happiest countries, you'll see a list based on the various scales. The happiest countries are not all alike. And what's weird about Costa Rica, very unusual, is that Costa Rica punches above its weight, as it were, in terms of happiness, health, and subjective well-being. Costa Rica is a middle-income country. I think it's like 54th in terms of their gross national product. Not a rich country. It's in a bad neighborhood. It's got a lot of problems. All you have to do is try driving from San Jose to the ocean, and you'll see the problems. But despite all those problems, Costa Rica was beating out places like Norway and Sweden and Canada in terms of gross national happiness. which was a phrase that was coined by the king of Bhutan when he was 22, even though other countries have tried to take up or not take that up. The anomaly, the paradox, is that Costa Rica is a small country about the size of West Virginia with a middle income base. It doesn't have a lot of industry. It's not thriving in a big-time economic way. And yet, overall, by every measurement you can look at, health, maternal effects, pregnancy, longevity, Costa Rica is up with Scandinavian countries, Canada, way above the United States, in terms of doing well. And so that's what we were looking at. But how come Costa Rica is doing so well when its neighbors in Latin America are not doing so well? And in fact, we took a map of the world and we drew a line with two magic markers and we looked at countries exactly at the same latitude of Costa Rica. You get Myanmar. You get places in Vietnam. Costa Rica is completely out of place if you just look at the geography of Costa Rica. So that's why we decided that what makes Costa Rica different?
I really like how all of the chapters communicate to each other. And in the chapter War and Human Nature, you raised interesting questions about the meanings and consequences of militarization and demilitarization, not only for Costa Rica, but also for the rest of the world. Right. And there is a particular argument that caught my attention. What are the implications of a decision like this, demilitarization, in a world that widely accepts the idea that war is part of human nature?
That's a wonderful question. Kenneth Boulding, who is a peace researcher, coined something called Boulding's First Law, which is that anything that exists is possible. That's really important. The fact that Costa Rica exists as a non-killing society with no army, and they also have laws against hunting. They also do not permit, for example, killing somebody who invades your house. The bullfights in Costa Rica, they don't kill the bulls. They don't even come close to killing the bulls. Costa Rica has lots of problems, but the fact that you can have a society without an army and where a non-killing society proves that human nature is not destined or doomed to have war. Now, we make the distinction, and it's important, that all beings, really from bacteria on up, compete with one another for resources. And there are genes, there are behavior throughout the plant and animal kingdom that show that animals compete, animals and plants compete, say, for sunlight, for nutrients, or protein. And I would say that competition for resources is part of our nature. But and maybe fighting. You can say one universal in people is that men tend to fight with one another over women. Throughout the world, the largest source of murder in the world are men either killing each other and fighting over a woman or killing the woman because he thought she was unfaithful. And that's true also in animals. Male-male competition is a universal. And some animals fight with their antlers or come with their teeth. I'll give you that. But war is, let's say sex is normal or natural. People are born with sexual inclinations. That doesn't mean that you have to wear a certain garment or practice a certain position or go to a certain place to have sex. It doesn't mean that in order to mate, you need to spend $50,000 on a wedding with a dress and that with a train 50 feet long and a bachelor party and a guest and whatnot. A wedding is a cultural phenomenon. Sex is biological. War, complete with nuclear weapons, drones, and high-flying aircraft and intercontinental ballistic missiles, is more like a wedding with all this cultural overlay. Whereas fighting, like fisticuffs, somebody punches somebody in the nose. A lot of war, and particularly the build-up to war and the defense budget in war-prone countries like the United States, is based on a very negative view and incorrect view of human nature that war is inevitable. What they're doing is confusing competition, which is, I think, pretty much inevitable, with war, which is a big cultural, expensive, very involved event. And they're not the same. So Costa Rica proves that war is not inevitable, even though men in Costa Rica fight quite a lot. And they fight with machetes. But they don't usually use guns because guns are illegal in Costa Rica. But they fight. At the bars, they get really drunk, they fight with machetes, they knock one another off their horses. But they don't have an army. And Costa Rica proves that war is not inevitable. That's the most important take-home message of this book.
Can you talk to us about the most important moments that led to demilitarization in the country? And just briefly talk to us about some differences or similarities with other parts of the world.
Costa Rica had been building up a fairly non-violent, non-military country for a long time. I may scramble my date, but I think Christopher Columbus touched base there in 1502. By 1823, Costa Rica was liberated from the Spanish Empire. During the period of the 1800s, which was the Age of Enlightenment in Europe, a lot of the rich people who were involved in the coffee industry went to France to study, and they were very influenced by the writings of Voltaire and Rousseau. So just like, kind of like Thomas Jefferson, the idea of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness came from the Enlightenment. The government of Costa Rica began to do things like giving women property rights very early on in the late 19th century. They did it interestingly. It's a funny story. Prostitution was legalized in the late 19th century in Costa Rica because Punta Arenas, the major port, was a great income source for the government. Because they sold liquor. They had a monopoly on the taxes from liquor, and they made the liquor. Women owned brothels. They sold sex. So they were able to buy property, and the government would collect taxes on the property. So everybody came out ahead by having prostitution legal, alcohol legal, and the government taxing everything. The Costa Rica never invested much in an army. They were invaded in 1857 by an American, William Walker, who was in line with the Confederacy, and he wanted to use Nicaragua and Costa Rica as a base to import slaves to the United States and other countries that were involved in slavery. Costa Rica thought that was a really bad idea. Walker came in, Costa Ricans mobilized, like 10,000 peasants put down their swords, chased Walker out, and then a young drummer boy named Juan Santamaria set fire to William Walker's abode. Juan Santamaria died, but the filibusters, William Walker, were sent out of Costa Rica. That was the first war since Columbus landed there, and there were 2,000 casualties. 2,000 casualties from that war. Okay, that was 1857. We skip forward in time. Costa Rica never had a big standing army because the Costa Rican government had decided back in a kind of a financial crisis in the early, like 1829, that instead of taxing peasants who were poor, they began to distribute land and give them ownership and full clear titles so that anyone could have a sustainable farm to raise a family. And the idea was that people who had sustainable farms to raise a family would be happy, and again, they would pay taxes. So most of the Costa Rican economy was based on small-scale farming. It could be amazing what you could do with 5 acres and a pig and a cow. This is a lift. If you skip forward, I'm talking maybe too much detail, but there was conflict in the early 1940s between a man named Calderon, who had become president, and who was in favor of a lot of things like social welfare programs, and other people who were maybe more progressive. There was a civil war in 1848 where a farmer named Jose Figueres mobilized on his own a private army, and he kicked out the elected representative of the Calderon government named Yolate and had a temporary coup that lasted 18 months. The first thing he did, Figueres, was make communism illegal, which was a really smart thing because that got him out of sight of the United States. He had studied at Harvard, he'd gone to MIT. So once communism was illegal and they couldn't claim to be big communism, Figueres was free to do what he wanted. So he took a sledgehammer, he beat down the door of the armory where the few pathetic military soldiers kept, and he handed the keys to the Minister of Education. He literally gave the money that would have been for the military to the Minister of Education. He also started universal health care in 1948. Universal education, the right to have transit stops like bus stops at small villages. He was in rule for 18 months. He peacefully handed control back to Yolate and the other party. He was successfully elected later on as president again, but these progressive reforms that he'd instituted outlasted him. By 1848, there was zero military budget, but fully funded universal health care. They made efforts to have everyone get a telephone. They expanded the roads and infrastructure so even tiny villages could take buses. Oh, and they outlawed uniforms. This is a really cool thing. Costa Rica uniforms, other than school uniforms, are illegal. So when Obama went to Costa Rica to visit and the band was going to play, the Costa Rican so-called military band were wearing grown-up versions of children's school uniforms.
Where this decision came from, or what it's trying to accomplish, banishing uniforms?
The only permitted uniform in Costa Rica are school uniforms, So there are two kinds of police in Costa Rica. They're tourist police and then they're regular police. But they all wear variations on school uniforms. There's the idea of a uniform that represents state authority is not allowed. I don't know who came up with the idea. That's a good question. But it's an example of the kind of rejection of militarism. Now, sometimes school children are so poor, they don't have the money to get a uniform. The issue of poverty is very real, and so paying for school clothes and books and all is difficult. But the demilitarization is so intense that you can't tell a policeman from a Coast Guard person. They all wear these blue uniforms.
That's fascinating. And I mean, that actually, I think, paves the way for the next question, because there's an entire chapter dedicated to study good luck as a variable that could help us understand the possible relationship between the high level of national well-being and demilitarization. Why did you decide to analyze the idea of good luck, and what is your proposal as authors in this regard?
We thought and thought about how can we break this down to a manageable topic, and we decided that one element of Costa Rica, why they did so well, was good luck. Another was good decisions and good leadership. In good luck, Costa Rica had a lot of good luck for no apparent reason. For example, there have been very few extremely decimating earthquakes in Costa Rica. Even though they have 8 major, huge volcanoes, and the volcanoes erupt, and tourists can go see them. Occasionally, Turrialba spews ash all over the place, but there's been nothing like the earthquakes in Nicaragua, for example, that have killed so many people. The tornadoes and hurricanes, for whatever reason, Costa Rica gets a lot of rain in the rain season, and there have been mudslides. But actual hurricanes are almost unheard of, either on the Atlantic or the Pacific side. There haven't been great, devastating storms. So, again, what can you say but good luck? There's another really more important piece of good luck that is militarization, which is that Costa Rica lacked minerals that the Spanish wanted to export. So it's like the old song, I got plenty of nothing. Even though Christopher Columbus and some subsequent Spanish explorers were impressed by the gold and some of the chief necklaces and things, it turned out Costa Rica doesn't have much gold, no silver. It's not like Bolivia. If you read Eduardo Galeante's Open Veins of Latin America and look at the effects of Spanish exploitation in most of Latin America, it was based on minerals and natural materials. Costa Rica didn't have it. Costa Rica is a really hard place to get around. The soil isn't exceptionally good, except maybe in the Central Valley. So the people who settled in Costa Rica were mostly from Spain, were going to a place where they knew they were going to be in an agricultural environment. They're going to work the soil. They're going to have to work it hard. And there weren't a lot of shortcuts. And in that sense, Costa Rica kept under the vision of the Spanish Empire, who would have raped Costa Rica like it raped Bolivia if there had been minerals to take. Costa Rica is and was, remains a predominantly agricultural place. They've branched out from bananas. They grow cardamom. They grow lots of interesting spices. They've had little bits of industry there. Intel had a factory, but closed. But big time things like coal mining, gold rush, it didn't happen then. So Costa Rica slipped under the view of the colonialists who wanted to take minerals from other parts of the world and take them to Europe for secondary manufacture. That was good luck. Costa Rica also is an isthmus. It's a small place where cultures intermingled. Animals and people went north to south and south to north. There were the Incas and Mayans coming from the south. There were people, some people, particularly Spanish, coming from the north. Also animals came from south and north. So it was a transit way. Lots happened. But they weren't decimated like the Mayans and Incas who were involved in whatever, cannibalism and human sacrifice. They just never got that far. And the Aztec Empire from Mexico overlooked Costa Rica, too. It slipped through the cracks, and much to their benefit. It's a hard place to get around. On the East Coast, it's really hot and muggy, and then the mountains start, and it's very, very difficult. It's very hard. It took a long time to get a railroad built from Limon to Santa Fe. On the West Coast, it's got two seasons. The soil isn't very good. It's good for growing cattle. But again, it's not an easy place to be. So they lucked out in terms of not being overwhelmed by colonialists.
And all of these circumstances related to good luck do not act in isolation. As you mentioned in your book, particularly in chapter 6, the country has also benefited from other circumstances like the international involvement in political decisions. And I quote this because I really like it. Some unintended consequences of Tico social life, end of quote. I would like to start with this idea. How would you describe Tico social life? It was particularly interesting when you explained some common phrases, as well as the lack of trust in leaders who do not present themselves as being of the people.
So a ubiquitous phrase in Costa Rica is pura vida, which I guess loosely translated is life is good, good life. And it's said as kind of a verbal tick in the middle of sentences, this morning I got up and I enjoyed the morning pura vida, and then I made coffee. It's used like in the middle of sentences as kind of a random interrupter. How are you doing? Pura vida. Life is good. It turned out the phrase was probably invented by the intelligentsia in the late 1890s as sort of a sales pitch, as a reinforcing psychology to help the peasants feel good about themselves, because you say, how are you doing? Pura vida. How are you? Pura vida. It repeats over and over. Life is good. Life is fun. There's not a lot of, I'm Jewish, but there's not a lot of kvetching in history. Life is good. There's another bumper sticker that says, Costa Rica, we make easy hard. That even though life is good, Costa Rica has a bureaucracy that's almost Stalin-esque, and it's very difficult to get anything done. But the attitude about that is very Pura Vida. Okay, well, my refrigerator's not working, but eventually the parts will come. You know, things are slow. People finish their sentences. Run into somebody in a store, and the conversations are very long. And they remember your family, who's there, ask about one another. There's a level of intimacy that I adore. We had a neighbor, Jenny, who had a baby. Jenny's people had lived in our little town for many, many years. She had a baby. It's a tradition in Costa Rica for everybody, all relatives, to have a baby and kiss it. 300 people came to kiss Jenny's baby. I couldn't imagine that. Our doctor, Andrea, she had grown up in San Jose, and in one block where she grew up, she had 37 cousins. There's a kind of social stability there, social and family stability, that just astounds me, because people move very much, leave, and their memories and connections to family are so deep that it's very different than the transitory communities I'm used to. Like, one time I was sick, and I was going to go to the hospital, and the person who was my helper, Nelson, he said to me, "You're going to the hospital? You're not going alone, are you?" I said, "Well, yeah, I'm going to the hospital." He said, "You can't go to the hospital alone." Well, it turns out in Costa Rica, somebody goes to the hospital, like 10 or 12 relatives go too, and they're spaced in the room for their beds and their family, and they hang out. They would never leave somebody in the hospital alone. It's just unthinkable. So they call that, there is something called the Hispanic advantage about happiness that you've probably explored on your show, looking at why cross-culturally Latinos and Latinas have happiness greater overall, if you believe in happiness concept. I think a deep part of that is the intensity of family connection. And so I got to experience that personally because, insofar as I was sort of adopted by, particularly they were Nicaraguan immigrants, but they wouldn't dream of leaving me alone. I was protected all the time and surrounded. Well, social life. Things are slow. Like, I would watch two men sitting on the bench near the ocean, and they would talk for an hour or more, and they did it every morning, and catch fish. And it was leisurely. That was part of their culture. On the other hand, part of the culture, which was old, I don't know if you know about this, but Costa Rica is considered a blue zone, particularly the Nicoya area, which is like 40 kilometers from where I lived. People in Nicoya, particularly the men, live longer than any other place in the world. There's less discrepancy in life mortality between males and females in the Nicoya area, particularly in a town called Ojancha, and any other place in the world. Why? Well, there's the diet and there's the community. The diet is that people eat the same thing three times a day, rice and beans, gallo pinto, and they eat gallo pinto three times a day, and then occasionally an egg, or they kill a chicken and eat it. Or if a cow gets killed by a truck in the road, everybody goes and takes parts of the cow and that makes stew. So you get protein where you can, but rice and beans. And so you could feed a family forever on a very stable diet. And the tortillas, the grain, has to be ground very specially by hand with potash, and it appears to make it's more healthy for the heart. Calcium is more accessible. So the grind, the preparation of food takes a long time, and the diet's very predictable. Okay, then the social life, add to that. Here are these people living in small areas. Say on Sunday morning, they want to go visit friends. So they walk 5 miles, go visit their friends, have a big feast, and walk 5 miles home. It's hard to get that way, right? Before the invasion of McDonald's and pizza parlors, people from the Nicoya area were quite slender. And there's one other thing that particularly amused me, which was sex. In Costa Rica, at least in that part, it was understood that people had multiple sexual partners. Monogamy wasn't, I mean, people got married. Churches are not a very big thing in Guanacaste. They're nowhere near as big as the beer ads. And men would have multiple marriages, but they also had multiple babies from people they weren't married to and had active sex lives well into the 80s. And the children, the offspring of unmarried women, were accepted into village life along with everybody else. There was no discrimination against, quote, bastards. So the acceptance of those full, exuberant sex life for both males and females, along with this family connection, along with the good food, I think it makes for a really good life.
And I think this is leading to a question that I think I must ask. After you wrote this book and lived it and researched about Costa Rica, what can the rest of the world learn from this country?
The first thing to learn is that war and militarism is not necessary. It's not in our genes. It's not hardwired. And Elaine White Gomez and other people from Costa Rica have taken leadership in the United States, in the United Nations, in promoting the total ban on nuclear weapons. Costa Rica has become a broker for international peace because there are 9 nations with nuclear weapons, 29 nations in NATO. Everyone else is subject to the whims of the 9 nuclear nations. And finally, under Costa Rica's leadership, places like Patagonia, Chile, even though they have nuclear-free zones in Latin America, they're going to die if the nuclear leaders make a mistake or make a choice, say an ill-informed choice. Costa Rica has become a leader in abolishing nuclear weapons and a leader in promoting peace studies. There's a University of Peace in Costa Rica. It's a lovely place, not far from San Jose. Costa Rica brokered the end of the war in Nicaragua. Costa Rica has firsthand experience in living, teaching, and brokering peace. I think that is the most important thing to learn from Costa Rica. Another thing is that once you abolish the military and reduce its spending, the peace dividend, so-called, is enormous. What you can do with all the money that's spent on weapons that can never be used, or just like big toys for big boys, you can build a whole lot of schools and universities and buses and equipment. You can do good things without a military. And Costa Rica shows that in a living way. The culture of peace, here's just one small example. Because, you know, in Spain, bullfights, I think, is entail like killing the bull. And it's bloody, and the bulls are going to the Pamplona. Costa Rica, at bullfights, there's the bull. And people, particularly old men, crowd into the arenas, and they dance. And bulls running around, and the people and horses, the picadors, like, sort of tease the bulls. The bulls are treated like rock stars. But meanwhile, people are not bullfighters at all. Go into the area with the bull, and they dance, and they're drunk. And the friendliness of that explodes into the rest of the culture. Once you take away the presumption of something evil in human nature that leads us to war, the creativity of a society of peace is just just wonderful, beautiful. And you wouldn't see that as probably as a normal tourist. A normal tourist would go see the volcanoes, go see the pretty beaches, go surfing. To actually experience some of these things, I think you have to be there for a long time. And I the book, in some ways, is a memoir because we left Costa Rica in 2014. There were sad and difficult things about Costa Rica, and when you compare it, say, to Manhattan, Costa Rica is a paragon of happiness, right? Things like organ trafficking, sexual trafficking, drugs, gangs, those things exist in Costa Rica, like in Manhattan, and there are probably more organ trafficking and sex trafficking in Manhattan than in Costa Rica. But in Costa Rica, it's up close and personal. I had a friend who opened her closet door and found six terrified women inside who'd been trafficked from Latin America. I hadn't been bribery. So the river was clogged and people were competing to build new houses. One builder went to the mayor and offered $50,000. His neighbor went to the mayor and offered $75,000. She paid more, she got the bid. It was transparent that graft, bribery, was real in a way that I had never experienced. So I don't want to say that this is a fantasy land. It's not a Disney theme park at all. There are crocodiles in the Rio Tocolas and lots of garbage in the river. I mean, that's where the happiness thing is so questionable. But the fact that peace, that people are not packing guns, they have machetes, okay. That's a big difference. And the fact that there are no nuclear weapons targeted at Costa Rica. That's a nice thing, because Costa Rica has no enemies. It's going to worry about. Maybe they'll get in trouble, but maybe there'll be a loose missile. But unlike the rest of us who've grown up under mutually assured destruction, Costa Rica's grown up under Puerto Vida and Tranquilo, and maybe yes, maybe no. I don't know if Mexico has similar expressions to that, of sort of shading answers so as to avoid conflict. Conflictual speech in Costa Rica, you don't get very direct conversation. Like again, I come from a Jewish background where things are so direct and so in your face, so interrupted. Costa Rica, you're more likely, my experience is one was more likely to get a shaded or ambiguous answer to avoid conflict, even though there was a disagreement that was somehow substantive. A culture of peace is like you're listening so nicely to me, not interrupting, and then I listen to you. This is a like Costa Rican type conversation. We're smiling, nodding. We're not having an interchange that would suggest that who's smarter. It pervades every aspect of like how little children deal with grown-ups. Children, like in the United States, there's this thing that someone wrote a book about nature deficit disorder, screen time, how much time children spend indoors. There's no nature deficit disorder in Costa Rica. We used to watch a boy who, 8 or 9 years old, he'd go out on the beach with maybe 8 or 9 dogs, and he would roll around in the sand, in and out, I never saw a grown-up in sight. Nobody's watching him. He wasn't taking swimming lessons. But he was outdoors all the time. I don't think he had an iPhone. And that deep connection with nature and the natural world is another take-home message. That Costa Rica is 5% of the world's biodiversity in the space of a country the size of West Virginia. And everywhere you look, the interesting animals. My friend Nelson, one night in the night, I don't know what he was doing, but he had gone outside, and a tamantula grabbed him, a sloth, on the wrist. Sloths have, talk about 9-inch nails. They have huge, long nails. So the tamantula grabbed Nelson, and Nelson had the presence of mind just to be quiet and sit. He figured if he panicked, the tamantula would puncture his arteries in his wrist. So he stood quietly, waited, and then he looked at him. I'm not going to hurt you. You're very tranquilo. Eventually, the tamantula slowly opened his grip, climbed back up the tree, and I got the picture. Like, no panico. That was another thing that my Spanish teacher kept saying, no panico. It's like the front page of the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. Don't panic. That is another part thing that I learned there. No panico. Tranquilo. Take it easy.
Well, Judith, definitely you, David, and of course the Costa Rican experience have given us a lot to think about and a lot of reflections to make through the book. I don't want to end this conversation without asking if you are working on something or what kind of project you have in mind.
I am, but I haven't decided exactly which area to go. We wrote, Dave and I wrote a proposal for a book about debunking nuclear deterrence. No publisher would take it because it had the word nuclear. They said it wouldn't sell. So David is writing a book about threats in general, which nuclear deterrence is one. I have three books I'm thinking about and taking notes on. One is about lies that start wars. For example, like the Gulf of Tonkin, or when Napoleon told the French that it would be really easy to take Russia. Russia was very rich, and they could go in and go out, and no problem. That's an interesting lie. Hitler also thought it would be easy to take Russia. He thought it would be so easy that he didn't give the soldiers from Germany winter shoes or socks because he thought he'd go in Russia, Soviet Union, and get out again. And of course, that didn't, Operation Barbarossa didn't work out so well. There are a lot of lies that start all fact. So I'm taking notes on that. Another thing related to that is a doctrine of informed consent. I feel that that concept is a highlighted form of what democracy means. That when you go see a doctor, in theory, the doctor should tell you what's wrong with you, what his proposed treatments are, what the side effects and benefits are of the proposed treatments, and what the alternatives are, including the alternative of doing nothing. I'm thinking about writing a book called Deformed Consent, which is about the disinformation that governments give people. That's the opposite of informed consent, which is necessary for functioning democracy. So that's one. And then finally, I got caught up in the Costa Rica book looking at the multi-generational trauma and the effects of colonialism. Because since Costa Rica was spared and has this 400-year history of relative peace in Territorio de Nicaragua, Mexico, I'm thinking about looking at that epigenetic effect of trauma and trying to look at the multi-generational transmission of trauma, both biologically and sociologically. So I know it's going on all three topics, but I'm not sure where it's going to settle.
Well, all of them sound like a really, really interesting project. I would be looking forward to listening more about them when the time comes. I want to thank you very much for being on the show today, Judith. Thank you very much. I really enjoyed this conversation.
Well, I really appreciate it. Thank you for interviewing me. And if your listeners have other questions, if you forward the questions to me, I would be happy to answer. I don't really want to answer individual inquiries via email, but if someone writes to you via the show and you send it to me, I'll respond to you, and I'd be happy to give responses, resources, references, anything I could. And I do urge people to visit Costa Rica and then to imagine a world without military. Like and how we could live in peace, kind of like John Lennon said. And let's imagine that a non-killing society in peace is possible. Costa Rica lives there as an example of what human nature can do.
Thank you, Judith. Definitely. And thanks everybody for joining us today. See you next time. Bye.